everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. We're back for the second part of our show here on February 17, 2015. Okay, glad I got all that out. Now, I am very excited. I'm bursting, okay? I cannot wait to start talking about Tef, truly. So let's get Kitty Burns on the show. She's been an ethical vegan for more than 24 years. Yes! And a gluten-free vegan since 2008, author of the Cookzine, or Cookzine, however you say it, Papa Tofu Loves Ethiopian Food. She's a creative force behind the popular blog Cake Maker to the Stars, found at kittycake.blogspot.com. You'll have to go to my website to see how she spelled it. No, I'll spell it. kittekake.blogspot.com. Kitty, thank you, thank you, thank you for Tef Love.
You.
Yes, well, you know, I have been after Rhiannon at Book Publishing to get you on the program for a long time, and when I first saw this book, I thought, oh, I have to have this book, and and then she said, well, you have to wait, it's not coming out until, actually, she didn't say any of that. I have no idea what her voice sounds like because we only email, but I had to be patient.
I don't know if I've ever met anyone so excited about Tef than you.
I'm excited to talk to you too. Yeah, I'm so excited, and we'll learn why Karen's excited about Tef in a moment. And then you were supposed to come on the show a few weeks ago. We had that horrible snowstorm. We had to postpone, and I'm so glad you were accommodating.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yes, so here we are. Oh, I have to breathe.
And do you still have snow?
It snowed a little bit today, but the sun is out, and I am in.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I have some guests visiting from Costa Rica, and they're leaving tomorrow morning, and I hope there weren't too many flights delayed so that they can get out and get back to their warm tropical weather.
Yeah, we're experiencing what we call here in Portland, Oregon, as February fake-out. Which when in, it's super sunny and warm today, and everybody comes out, and they think the rain and the winter is gone. And then as soon as March comes, everybody remembers that it's not spring yet. But it's really great today. I'm super enjoying it.
Yeah, so let's jump into Tef.
Okay.
Oh, now, I've known about Tef, but I didn't know it was Tef whenever I would go to an Ethiopian restaurant. Let's talk about Ethiopian food first, shall we?
Sure. I love talking about Ethiopian food.
Yes.
So in Ethiopian restaurants in North America, the injera, which is the fermented, spongy, delicious flatbread that most of the food is served on, is made from tef, but it's also cut with other grains. So it's an important thing to know for people that are gluten-free because although it's getting more popular to find 100% tef or gluten-free injera in restaurants, normally it's cut with barley flour, which also has
gluten.
Yeah, it has less gluten than other grains like wheat, but it definitely has gluten in it and also wheat flour.
I didn't know that. Good point, number one. So for celiac disease or serious gluten intolerance, the tef injera here in the United States is not for you, unfortunately.
Well, some of it is. And so what I've noticed over the last few years since tef and gluten-free foods in general are gaining popularity is a lot of restaurants will make it, but they have to make it special or separate. So you either have to ask for it or some restaurants, I know at least here in Portland, can do it if you call in like 24 hours in advance, so they have time to actually make you a special batter of it. So
that's because you live in very cool food country in Portland, okay, which is unlike anywhere. I mean, even though in New York we have absolutely everything, Portland is a concentrated focus on sustainable food.
So my family is from the D.C. area. That's actually where I'm originally from. And so maybe this is also not a good example because the D.C. area has a huge Ethiopian community, but I've noticed there as well that there are restaurants now that have pure tef injera. Because I'm gluten intolerant, and so that's important to me. When I eat out for Ethiopian, I definitely want to be able to enjoy the injera. And so there are a number of places in the D.C. area where you can find it, too. You just need to be diligent and know about it. I think that's the most important thing. And then ask for it, and then that way it creates a demand, and restaurants know that customers want it. Because I think part of the reason that it's cut. I mean, I think I've heard about all sorts of reasons, but one of the reasons I've heard is that it's maybe more palatable to a Western palate. when it's cut with wheat and cut with barley. And so, you know, if customers show that there's a demand for it, then I think it'll make it more available. Also, test flour is really expensive.
That's a problem, and we're going to fix that. We're going to fix that because we're going to make the demand greater. And here's, I wanted to talk about this later, but I guess I'm going to talk about it right now because I'm talking about it in my mind, and I'm going to share it with everyone right now. And that is, here's my vision. My vision is all the cattle ranchers out there, like in Nevada and other drought-ridden places, places that are really dry, and they're struggling because it's hard, and they think there's nothing else they can do with that property that won't grow anything. Grow teff.
Yeah, it's an amazing grain. That would be awesome. I do know there is some teff being grown in Nevada. Not a lot. I think most of domestic teff comes from Idaho. And did you know that it's illegal to export large quantities of teff from Ethiopia? I think that's important for people to know, too, so that most of the, most if not all of the teff available here, it's all domestically grown.
You know, that's such a good point. I'm glad you brought it up, and I did know that, although I forgot about it. And, you know, what a concept. So teff is a very important food in Ethiopia, and they're smart.
Yeah, super important.
They're smart, saying we're not going to export it and share it with the rest of the world so that people can take advantage and exploit our country because we've already got food security issues. And
even there in Ethiopia, I know it's they have trouble. I mean, it's such a staple there, and it gets cut with corn and sorghum and millet, even in Ethiopia, because it's expensive there for people to eat, too, and it's a staple. It's one of their main sources of protein.
Now,
so they can't even think about, like, exporting it because, I mean, I don't even know if they can produce as much as they'd like to keep in Ethiopia, you know, for everybody to eat there. So.
Right. Well, you know, there are other countries like Bolivia, for example. I don't they should have thought that way, too, because they started exporting quinoa. You just said it. Thank you.
I know. The quinoa problem is it's huge there because it just drove the prices right up. It's, like, not affordable for people that live there. But, yeah, I agree. They're so smart. I think they set this up a long time ago in Ethiopia, the export laws. You know, I'm sure that there's some restaurant owners from North America that probably go and fill up their suitcases with teff and come back. But, you know, even I'm really lucky in Portland. There's an Ethiopian grocery store literally 3 blocks from my house. And even the teff that they sell at that grocery store is all it's the mezcal teff, which is the Idaho grown teff, which is, it's pretty cool.
Do you know what you pay for it a pound? Just curious.
Well, the Bob's Red Mill that I think is probably, like, the easiest for most people to find is $8 for one of those small bags, which I think is 16 ounces, I'm not sure.
Wow.
But, you know, again, here in Portland, I can get it in bulk in most of the co-ops and supermarkets and stuff, I'm sure. Like, around the country, that's not possible. So I think probably most people would pay about $8 a pound, which is a lot.
Now, something I learned or reminded myself of when I got your book is...
Okay.
I had this, now I haven't made anything in here, I've just read it, and I'm kind of getting ready to stick my foot in the cold water, take the plunge. and in some way that's how it feels like, and I'm glad I'm feeling that way because I know so many people feel that way when they're changing their diet and just thinking about introducing a new food or eliminating some foods. You feel that, I don't know, some kind of fear or overwhelmed or you just don't know what's going to happen, and it takes a certain amount of energy to get you past that block.
Oh, I definitely agree. I mean, even the names of the recipes in the book are in Amharic, which is the national language in Ethiopia. But everything, you know, I thought that was important to do because that's what the food is called, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you just break it down, you know, I've gotten a lot of feedback from people, and I had a lot of people help me test recipes for the book, and like, one of the biggest things that people keep saying to me is how easy the recipes are to make. I think that if you kind of just break down the steps, like, there are a few things that you need to make that are the basis of the recipes. For instance, the seasoned oil. And once you have the seasoned oil made, you just keep it in your refrigerator. And then if you want to make red lentils or if you want to make some vegetables, then, you know, you can put it together and it can be a weeknight meal, no problem. But I do think you're right that when you're just looking through the book, it kind of is a little bit overwhelming, but then when you break it down into small steps, mm-hmm. the recipes are actually really manageable and amazingly, like, nutrient dense, like so many legumes, vegetables.
Well, I'm excited. I'm excited because, you know, I'm like out there at the end of the spectrum in this vegan world, and it's great to find a new food that I haven't tried before, that I haven't made before. Now, I've had in the restaurants, but I haven't made it, and I'm really excited. But let's just mention a few things about Ethiopian food. Number one, this injera pancake thing. I don't even know, am I saying it right?
Injera. Injera.
They don't use utensils eating this food.
No, it's so fun.
Yeah, so you have to wash your hands first.
Yeah, that's really important, especially when you're eating with other people.
I mean, it's important in general to wash your hands before you eat, period. And so these little, there are all these different kinds of food. For people that are familiar with Indian food, it's kind of similar in that you have these different soft blends of foods, beans and vegetables.
Mm-hmm. One of the main food groups is something that's called Wot. W-O-T, Wot. Mm-hmm. And it's basically like, it's interesting because, you know, North Americans kind of describe it as a stew, but native Ethiopians describe it more as a sauce. And I think that's really important when you're making the recipes at home, because I think we tend to think of like Indian food and it's more like stew-like, but Ethiopian food is supposed to have a sauce and it's supposed to soak into the injera underneath. I mean, that's one of the most delicious parts, right? Like after you've scooped up the food and eaten it with the bread and all of the toppings are gone, you have this like succulent injera that's soaked up the sauces from everything you've made underneath. So, yeah.
Okay, now briefly, just hold my hand here.
Okay.
And tell me what I need to do to make this wonderful teff-based injera.
Okay, I'm here for you. I'm going to hold your hand. So making injera is really fun. It's a fermented food. So if you want to make injera, you don't need a lot of ingredients. So also, just to back up, when I make injera, I make 100% teff injera, and that's what the recipe in the book is for. There's like a little variation if you want to add other grains to it, you can, but I like pure teff injera the most. So really what you want to do is you want to start with a sourdough. And for people that are familiar with sourdoughs, and if you're not gluten intolerant, it doesn't have to be the sourdough in the bread. You just want something that is an active starter that has wild yeast in it. Another thing that you might not know, Karen, that is super interesting about teff is that teff is one of, if not the only, grains in the world that has a symbiotic yeast as part of the grain.
Mm.
And when you hear about folks in Ethiopia that have moved to other parts of the world and they have trouble making injera, like in their new homes, one of the reasons, as they're saying, because I was just reading before, I was going to talk to you today about it, about the domestic, the American-grown teff, is that they're not sure that the American-grown teff has the same symbiotic relationship with the yeast, and that might be why it's harder to make outside of Ethiopia, because I was reading that there could be, like, environmental differences or even, like, the acidity in the water could be different enough that that symbiotic relationship isn't there. So, like, I know a lot of, like, when I was researching for the book, a lot of the recipes that I've seen say, you just mix teff flour with water and leave it out, and the wild yeast will find it, and then you can make your injera. But then a lot of people who try that don't have a lot of success. So what I did in the book is I have a recipe that's for a teff-based sourdough starter, but I add a little bit of yeast to it to get it going. Mm-hmm. Because another thing that I've read is it could be that even just that the symbiotic yeast is on the whole grain teff, but once the teff is ground into a flour, that the yeast dissipates.
Right.
Which is interesting to me. So anyway, so for the starter, that's what I do in the recipe is it's just water, teff flour, and yeast.
Okay.
And then you just feed it a little bit of teff flour every day for a few days. And once you have that starter made, because it takes about 5 days to get it going. You don't have to do that every time you make the injera. You just keep it in the fridge, and then when you want to make some injera, you take it out, you bring it to room temperature, you add a little bit of Teflar to it to wake it up and reactivate the yeast that's in there, and then it'll take like another almost 2 days to make the actual injera, but not quite.
All right, now
the injera... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
The starter... you just kind of keep it around all the time?
Yeah, you have to be careful if you're, like, if it's in the middle of summer and it's, like, 90 degrees outside, it doesn't do, like, really, really well. If it's super hot, you don't want to, like, over-ferment it. You just, it needs a little bit more babysitting. And then the same thing, like, when
that happens to a lot of friends of mine in the summer. They get over-fermented.
Yeah, I think it's true for, like, any kind of ferment you're trying to do in the heat. You just have to watch it a little bit more because it just ferments, like, a lot faster.
Right.
And then, and the same thing in the cold, it's, you know, it slows down. So I give, like, instructions in the recipes, like, what to do if it's hot or what to do if it's cold. But, yeah, you don't really do anything to it. You just kind of stir it up every day and feed it a little bit more flour. And then it gets bubbly. It's really cool. It's just like it'll be bubbling away when you know it's ready to go. And then to make the injera batter, it's just some of the starter that you made, filtered water, which is really important to use because you don't want to use tap because there's things in tap water that can kill the culture, you know, like bleach and things like that. Mm. And then you just add filtered water and a little bit of fenugreek and more flour, and then you let that sit around. And it makes a batter that's thinner than a pancake batter, maybe a tiny, tiny bit thicker than a crepe batter. I have a video on my blog if people are curious and they want to sort of see what the texture is like. It should be thin enough that you can pour it from the pitcher, but there's a video that was recently shot in my kitchen. I'm making injera, and you can actually see it. I think that's, like, really helpful to have a visual.
You know, I just realized this. I think the universe works in mysterious ways. And today,
what?
Being pancake day, I didn't realize it.
Yeah.
That's
funny.
And Teff is kind of like a pancake, but you also use your Teff starter to make sourdough pancakes.
Yeah, it makes really delicious pancakes. I figured that out because one of my friends in town who was helping me test recipes had a whole bunch of the starter left over, and she didn't want to make injera, so she was like, what should I do with this? And I was like, well, I don't know, but I'm going to find out. And so I made a pancake recipe, and it's really, really good. It has, like, a really nice tang to it that I think goes really great with them. It's got cinnamon and blueberries in it, and also a little bit of sorghum, a little tapioca, just because teff flour is a really heavy flour, and I think, like, it's perfect for injera, but for regular baking, you need to lighten it up a little bit. And so usually when I bake, that's what I use. That's, like, my favorite combo is a little teff flour, a little sorghum, a little tapioca starch. But, yeah, those pancakes are good.
Yeah.
You should maybe try those first. Ease yourself in.
Now, there's... lots of wonderful recipes in here, not just to make the injera, but to make all the different dishes that you'll put on top and you can dip in and soap up, and it's just delicious. Now, are there, aside from teff, are there any other ingredients in some of these recipes that would seem foreign to us simple Americans?
Probably. Spice, that's really, really important. It's one of the, like, strongest flavor profiles in Ethiopian cooking, and it's a red spice blend that is based from a chili powder, and it's called berberi, and it's what makes all of the red saucy wat and, like, the stews and the sauces. And I have a recipe for that in the book, but if people want to make this food and they live in any kind of metro city, they should probably be able to buy it in an Ethiopian market, or the spices that go into it can be found in Indian markets, or my preference, I mean, it's such an important flavor profile for the food. If for people that really, you know, are gung-ho about recreating the recipes at home, I suggest even ordering it online. You can get it from, there's folks in town that, in the States that import it straight from Ethiopia, and then that way you can really get the flavor. And when I lived in New Orleans, you know, we didn't have access to any I mean, we had Indian grocery stores there, but otherwise, I would either get my mom to send it to me from D.C. or I would go to an Indian grocery store and buy most of the spices. So it can be done, but you definitely need to invest in a few things. And then I tried my hardest in the book to show what spices are optional, because I wanted people to be able to make things really super authentic if they wanted to. And I know, like, a lot of cooks and a lot of vegan cooks in particular love, like, the chase of finding special ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know a lot of people don't want to deal with that. So I really did try to break the recipes down and show spices that are optional whenever they are. But you do definitely need to find a berber. You either need to make it or find it in the shop or buy it from a distributor.
Okay. Now I'm just thumbing through here, and I'm looking at the Yashiro Whatbi Souf, and I probably butchered the pronunciation.
Oh, what page are you on?
112. It uses sunflower seed milk. And I'm just wondering,
yes.
Is that something that you came up with, or is that something traditional in Ethiopian cuisine?
No, that's something traditional that I have an Ethiopian friend. Her name is Hiru, and she's one of my friends in New Orleans, and she was telling me about this. So in the Shura, like, I've heard about it. So sunflower seeds are, you know, a big crop in Ethiopia, and so they show up in traditional food. And the traditional dish that I've heard of before, because I've seen it in restaurants, is there are dishes that are called fit-fit and furfur dishes, and they're injera-based dishes. They kind of translate to, like, fit-fit is sort of like a bread salad, and furfur is more of, like, if you think about kind of like a savory bread stuffing, you know, kind of like even what you'd have on Thanksgiving, but not those flavors, but kind of that thing, the way the stuffing gets soft and has, like, onions and savories in it. You know, it's sort of similar to that.
Mm.
And there is something called souf fit-fit, which is injera, and there's a recipe for it in the book, and toasted sunflower seed milk, which you make, is poured over the injera. It's a perfect way to use, like, you know, injera that's maybe 1 or 2 days old and it's a little bit dry, and it just soaks up the milk, and then you add maybe a little jalapeno, maybe some onion, you could put tomato in it or red pepper, and it's one of my favorite recipes in the book. When I started researching it and making the fit for dishes, I was just dancing around the kitchen. It's really delicious.
I do that a lot, dance around the kitchen.
Yeah.
Well, it caught my eye because I've been looking, in the vegan world, we use nuts and seeds sometimes to replace our standard milk, dairy products, milk and cheese, and
sure.
We've been using a lot of sunflower seeds and pumpkin seeds blended with water to make salad dressings and different like cheese kind of spreads, and so I was excited to see that was there.
Yeah, it's totally similar. Besides that fit-fit I was telling you about, there's 3 recipes in the book that have the toasted sunflower seed milk, and my favorite is the Misr Wat, which is, you know, the ubiquitous spicy red lentils that you get in Ethiopian restaurants. But it's made with, instead of water, it's made with the toasted sunflower seed milk. So it kind of is reminiscent of more like of a West African groundnut stew, if you kind of know this flavor. So it's got some heat from the Berberi in it, and then this toasted sunflower seed milk is just really savory, but it's cooling at the same time and rich. It's one of my favorite recipes in the book.
Sounds really delicious, and I'm really hungry now, and we're at the end of the half hour. So, Kitty, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks,
and
Karen.
I can't wait to devour your book, Tough Love.
I'm here to hold your hand if you need me. Just
oh,
get
thanks.
In touch.
Good. Okay, take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. That was Kitty Burns, author of Teff Love. Visit her at kittycakeblog.blogspot.com. And I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Visit me at Responsible Eating and... Oh, goodness. You know where to go. ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. Like us on Facebook if you haven't, okay? And like this show on... Rate this show on iTunes. All right. Other than that, have a delicious week.